A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and welcome back to These Times. I'm Tom McTay.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
This week we're turning back to the UK after last week's announcement by Rishi Sunak in Berlin that the UK will increase its defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030 to become what he called by far the largest defence power in Europe in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
The question we're going to ask in this week's episode is, will the UK be able to align what it can spend on defence with the changing geopolitical world?
With fears of a future conflict growing, the UK and its NATO allies are mobilising. Hundreds of British Army vehicles are bound for Germany. From there, they'll head to Poland, along with more than 1,500 troops.
What China is doing, or what some of its enterprises are doing, is to provide critical components for Russia's defence industrial base.
I believe we must do more to defend our country, our interests, and our values. So today I'm announcing the biggest strengthening of our national defence for a generation. We will increase defence spending to a new baseline of 2.5% of GDP by 2030.
In fact, Estonia's spy agency is warning that Moscow is preparing for confrontation with the West within a decade, something a rapid rearming of NATO militaries could deter.
So as ever, Helen, let's start with the history of this, because I think it is so revealing of what we are trying to do today. I mean, the obvious place to start is the end of the Second World War, 1945, and Britain's presence as the last remaining great power in Europe, at least in Western Europe. And what we do from that point, we were the main presence in Greece, we were the main presence in Turkey, in the Middle East. But in 1946, we already begin the withdrawal of forces from Greece in particular, which leads to the Truman Declaration guaranteeing America's presence in Europe for the defense of democracy, as he called it, but also from Turkey. But where we don't pull out is from the Middle East. That's where we want to keep the line.
I think it's really important to see in telling the story about the relationship between the geopolitical world and what British governments are trying to do with the defence policy is to see how central initially the Middle East is to what is going on. And that's in part, as you said, Tom, because withdrawal from Greece and Turkey, but not from the Middle East. But it's also, and we've stressed this point a number of times, I think, now, because the United States itself, Truman does not want the United States to be militarily in the Middle East. So American military planning about a war with the Soviets in the second half of the 1940s requires Air Force being deployed from a British military base at Suez. And that actually has to be built, reconstructed. And if you said, I think, prior to like even 1948, one could argue perhaps about 1949, because that's the year that NATO's formed, what is the principal commitment in British defence policy? I would say it was to the Middle East, in the Middle East, and both defending that flank from a Soviet attack and acting as a protector for Western European energy security interests in the Middle East.
And I guess the other flank then is Europe itself. And as you say, the creation of NATO. And this is a time when the Americans are trying to solidify Europe as a force to be able to hold back the Soviets on this in this part of the world. And it's a time when you're talking about the Western European Union is created from Britain, France, the Benelux countries, I think, not Germany to begin with. This eventually becomes sort of merges into NATO with America's sort of being the lodestar in Western Europe. And then something sort of key happens. And these things are happening at the same time is you have the Schuman Declaration, which is encouraged by the Americans, the beginning of today's European Union, the beginnings of the federalization of Europe at American encouragement. At this exact moment that that is happening in Korea, you have the invasion from the North Koreans into the South. And I think there's an amazing moment in the House of Commons where they're debating the Schuman Declaration when a note is passed along on the government front bench about this invasion. So you're seeing the sort of new world forming. And this is a moment, I think, when Britain has something like 500,000 troops in its military. It is a big military power with presence in the Middle East, as you say. So although we're withdrawing, we're still the strongest military power in Europe, and we are still a partner that will be involved in a war as far away as Korea on behalf, alongside the Americans. That's the world that exists at that point.
Yeah, I think that we can see that Korea is a real shock on the defense side. If you just look at it in terms of defense spending, so the amount of gross national product or gross domestic product that's going on defense, I think at the end of the Second World War, it's around 16%. It's come down to 6% prior to the Korean War. So although these defense commitments that are upheld in the Middle East are pretty important, it's still part of a picture of coming down from wartime into peacetime. If you look at defense expenditure as a percentage of GDP by the end of the Korean War in 1952, it's back to 11%. Again, wow. So this looks more like wartime than it does like peacetime. So in this sense, this is a story, and this story really is going to repeat itself, where there's planning for one kind of world, which is falling defense expenditure centered on the Middle East. And then a geopolitical shock comes along and completely changes that. And in the wake of that, it's not only a question of sending troops to Korea and fighting in that war, it's having to rethink what the nature of the commitment to Western Europe is. And in particular, to ending with, by the middle of the decade anyway, the 1950s, I mean by that, a really strong military commitment to West Germany that involves significant amount of British troops in West Germany.
Yeah, which would stay for the rest of the century. I mean, we will come to this in the second half, but reading the Cameron era strategic defense reviews, and you're talking about withdrawing British troops in 2010, I think it is, that there's still a military presence there. I think it's interesting, as you say, that the planning for a world that never quite comes into existence, it seems to be this sort of recurring theme of British defense spending and British defense strategy. But it's also this kind of question that hangs over it, which is like, what is the point of it underneath? Like, what is the strategic goal? What are we trying to achieve as a country? Is it just Britain's defense? Is it Britain's economic security in a way? I mean, are we just protecting oil supplies, energy supplies in the Middle East? Or is there something else that we're trying to do? We're trying to maintain a global role, a global influence of some description. And that is obviously focused mainly on the United States from very early on, the ability to act with them and to protect that the world that has come into being at the end of the Second World War.
I think that what you can see in this period is that UK governments want to be a player. They want to be a geopolitical player with defence commitments to match that. They've got a role that the Americans have both given them and they want themselves in the Middle East. But even at this point, I'd say that there's a vulnerability, a sense that maybe that British governments are trying to do more than the British economy can ultimately withstand. And I think the point, and I know we've talked about this before, so we shouldn't dwell on it perhaps too much, where all this comes to its first big head is the Suez Crisis in 1956. Because this is a moment when the British government under Anthony Eden is in one sense doing what it's supposed to do, which is to exercise British military power, this time in conjunction with France and Israel, to defend not only British economic interests in the Middle East, but West European more generally. An American president not only says, no, you can't do that, but says no in such a way that puts immense pressure on Sterling and really brings into very sharp focus the issue of the gap, if you like, between Britain's economic position and the way in which British governments want to spend money and exercise military power.
Yeah, because there's an idea that the military power that we have gives us influence in the United States and in Europe, and therefore is a core part of our arsenal in protecting our economic interests, which lie at the heart of everything. But when you look back over the history, you wonder why it didn't come into more question earlier. And in fact, though, why it still isn't coming into question today. Let's take the United States and the situation you've just painted there, Helen. We ultimately didn't have any influence over the United States when it came to it in Suez. In Europe, we had assumed that our military presence, our military power, would really stop the Europeans from doing something without us, that they would go off on their own course. But what seems to have happened, I mean, particularly France, that, you know, we'd had this alliance with France, obviously during the Second World War. France wouldn't give that up for an alliance with Germany. But they were able to do that to create what became the European Union because the transfer of power as a security against German power or then subsequently Soviet power was transferred from Britain to the United States. And the United States was so much more powerful than Britain. So France had its security anchor. It didn't need to give Britain a veto over the future direction of Europe. And you see Britain struggling with this kind of reality that has come into being after the Second World War across the world. And yet our policy kind of remains to protect this military power so we can protect our influence. You know, and you've already seen during the Second World War, the fall of Singapore brings into question Britain's commitment or ability to defend Australia. Australia then responds to that and deepens its connection with the United States. India has gone by the time of the Korean War. So our entire global position has shifted. And as we've talked about before, you know, the commitments in the Middle East, Palestine have already gone as well in 47, 48. This is a totally transformed world, but it doesn't seem like our idea has transformed.
But I think that there's another level of complexity to that, Tom, though, and that is like what happens in the aftermath of Suez. And you've talked about this in a different context before, which is the French reaction to the Suez crisis is very different than the British reaction. And I think what you can see on the British side is a very acute sense now that Sterling, the currency, presents in some sense some limits around what British defence policy can be, and certainly the exercise of military power. But there isn't the same desire, if you like, to say, right, we can't be in Suez. We can't be in the Middle East. And I think you see that tension really clearly in the first big defence review, the Sandus review, that comes out in 1957. Now, the context of that isn't actually just the Suez crisis. It's also the growing importance of intercontinental ballistic missiles. And what does that mean for the need for conventional forces?
So is this under Macmillan by that point?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what you can see in that report or that review is a judgment that actually things can't carry on as they are, that there needs to be a reduction in the amount of manpower that is devoted to the armed services. So this is the review that will lead to the end of national service. And one of the arguments that's made for that is saying that there's an economic cost to having so many men bound up still with military service. But it's also saying, and this is an argument that is going to continue as we know, including to where we're going in this, that the West European allies need to do more themselves when it comes to conventional forces in Western Europe. And I think there's a moment a bit later, perhaps, when Macmillan's trying to decide what to do about the European Economic Community and like whether Britain, he doesn't want Britain to join the European Economic Community at that point, but he wants Britain to have a free trade agreement with the European Economic Community. And he wants to be able to say, look, if you don't give us that, then we're pulling out our troops.
Yeah, from a recurring theme.
But he can't. It's not a meaningful threat for the reason that you said, that there's the American commitment, and the ultimate defence of Western Europe at this point is the nuclear umbrella. And interestingly, that is actually, in one sense, the premise of the Sanders Review in the first place. So these things have become incredibly tangled.
Yeah,
but what you don't see after the humiliations of the Suez Crisis is a British government saying, actually, we can no longer afford to have a defence policy that is centred on the Middle East as well as the conventional forces in Western Europe. The response in the Middle East is to say, we can't stay in Suez any longer because of NASA. We need a new base, and that's going to be Aden. And we've talked about that in the episode that we did on the Red Sea. And in that sense, there is a response to the geopolitical shock that the Suez Crisis represents in terms of the alignment between the geopolitical commitment and defence policy. But it's not really to pull away from it. That drama of drawing from Easter Suez, which we get to in a moment, is going to take a little bit longer to play out.
Yeah, there's two things going on, isn't there? So there's the realisation that we can't afford effectively the geopolitical commitments that we had, and so we're trying to wind those down in a way that we can protect our power as much as possible. But also, as you say, the military power that we do have is no longer enough to give us the power of being a kind of balancing power in Europe any longer. And that's because of the United States. So there's two big changes that are going on. And then you see that in 67. I mean, I was just thinking, as you're talking there, Helen, about Macmillan and the use of intercontinental missiles. I mean, this is actually it's even more tangled, isn't it? Because de Gaulle uses this as a reason to reject us coming into Europe. So when Macmillan changes his mind and says, okay, you've pushed aside our threat and then you've rejected our application for a free trade area, now we want to join the European Economic Community, de Gaulle says no, because he says of the closeness of the relationship with the United States, particularly on the question of nuclear cooperation. And that is in, I think that is in 63. And that's after Macmillan goes off for this summit with the Americans on that position. In Parliament at this point, you have different factions, but you have factions like the Empire Loyalists who want to, on the right of the Conservative Party, who want to protect Britain's presence. And you have those led by Enoch Powell who say, no, it's gone. It's gone. It's time to withdraw. Accept Britain's loss of power in these and concentrate on the nation itself. And I suppose you see those playing out in the debates about withdrawing from East of Suez at 67 under Wilson, but he's very, very reluctant to do this.
He is. I think you can say that tension plays out in the Labour Party as well. Mm. So if you take Harold Wilson, he's still saying essentially Britain can't afford to relinquish its world role. But even before the events of 1967 around the Arab-Israeli war and the uprising in Aden that pushes the British out and leads to the withdrawal from East of Suez announcement in January of 1968, you already have Dennis Healey, who's the Defence Secretary for Wilson, making arguments that British economy, particularly financially around sterling, cannot withstand the defence commitments that Britain has. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that as a sequence of events from the closure of the Suez Canal in June of 1967 through to the East of Suez announcement in January 1968, there's a sterling crisis that runs through it that leads to the devaluation of sterling in November of 1968. 67. And I think you can say that this is a story in which the weakness of the British currency has undermined British defence policy. And this is an issue that I think might yet reoccur again in terms of where Rishi Sunak or probably somebody else, Keir Starmer, will be going in terms of being able to honour the commitment that Sunak has now made to get to 2.5% by 2030.
Does that, Helen, does that play, that same fear play into, I'm jumping forward slightly here, but into the early Thatcher years when she starts trying to wrestle with the same problem of Britain's commitments and our inability to pay for them, when she starts trying to cut military spending early in her career? Because I forget the periods when the pound is strong and weak in Thatcher's time, but there is a threat of a kind of sterling crisis early on, if my memory serves me right.
I think that the Thatcher story is interesting because it comes at a moment when there's been another geopolitical shock, which is the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. And the Iranian crisis. But I think that affects British policy less than it does the Americans. It's a moment when the Second Cold War is occurring, if we think about détente during the 1970s. And the Thatcher government, the first Thatcher government, is very keen on raising overall defence expenditure. It wants to end that, if you like, narrative of defence decline. But although it's not dealing with a sterling crisis at the time in 1981, it's more dealing with a set of fiscal problems, in part because of the weakness of the UK economy, the recession at that time. When it comes to deciding how both to spend more money and deal with the fiscal constraints, the Thatcher government has to make a decision. It has another defence review, the Knott review. So John Knott was Thatcher's first defence secretary, I think. And the stated purpose of the Knott review was to realign the UK's armed forces with the realities of the financial situation whilst trying to increase the amount of money in terms of GDP that was going on defence. And it makes a recommendation, which is then implemented, that the Navy is going to take the brunt of the cut. So it's an assumption that the world in which there's going to be naval conflict is gone, and that what's more important, and remember that this is a world in which Britain has withdrawn from the Middle East, what is more important, the land forces in continental Europe. Here we run into one of those repetitive moments in this story where an event happens that completely derails the plan, which is the Falklands War. So actually, a naval ice patrol ship, HMS Endurance, had been withdrawn from the South Atlantic as a consequence of the Knott review. And then we get the invasion of the Falklands by Argentina and Britain having to fight a naval war.
You know, in one sense, Helen, you know, it's amazing that Margaret Thatcher didn't get more political flack over that decision. But, you know, the victory in the war sort of saw to that, that it wasn't the thing that was remembered. But I think you can also, it's also defensible, isn't it, when you think about what the world that she's facing, that she's obviously looking towards the Soviet Union as the main threat. And that's a legitimate decision that was taken that said, look, we can only do so much. Let's focus on the main threat, which is the Soviet Union, tanks, the invasion, land invasion from the east. And you see that this kind of, as you say, you see this being repeated, the fact that you cannot control for the world that is going to, events that are going to happen the minute you decide to make a change, the minute you decide to try and order the world in your own head and make decisions based on that understanding of the world, something else is going to happen. I mean, the other obvious example of this is the end of the Cold War in the 90s, and we say there's a peace dividend and we begin to cut down on our military spending. George Bush does this almost immediately. I think Thatcher is actually quite critical of this decision very early on, but then she is removed, replaced by John Major. And again, you can understand it's completely logical that you'll want to take the win and spend the money on something else. And the Americans also start to say, Europe, you need to step up into this world. We can't continue as if nothing has changed with the American presence in Western Europe remaining as it was during the Cold War. And then, of course, it's not that long in the grand scheme of things before that world begins to disappear, and the idea of a peace dividend seems kind of...
Well, there's the Gulf War, the first Gulf War.
Of course, yeah.
Before, in a way, the peace dividend has even got going.
Yeah, months, yeah.
But I don't think there's any doubt that the end of the Cold War is a pretty important turning point in this story. There's a further sharp decline in the amount of defence expenditure in relation to GDP.
I think we're down to something like 4% of GDP by this point, Helen, which is a dramatic decrease from what we were talking about in the 50s.
It's falling quite rapidly, as you say, Tom, by this point. I think we can see that as the peace dividend years go on, so we're now into like the late 90s and in the Blair period, there's a hope that Blair, initially at least, has until the second Iraq war gets in the way, that there's not just a peace dividend, but there's a way of, in some sense, Europeanising British defence in this period, largely through getting closer to the French, that the end of the Cold War has diffused some of those tensions that the French had in relation to NATO, though they won't actually rejoin the military side of NATO until 2009. But even there, I think you can say that British defence policy is a bit caught unawares, because the world in which Blair is imagining that British-French cooperation, defence cooperation, can be the basis of a European Union level security commitment, is not one that can be so easily accommodated in the post-2001, 9/11 world, in which the Americans want a more assertive foreign policy in the Middle East, because that question is going to divide the European Union very bitterly. And the attempts that Blair made to say that Britain would have a less national defence policy in some sense fall apart in the wake of the second Iraq war.
Well, Blair's, I mean, really fascinating on this. We haven't got time now to get into it, but his idea is that Britain will be a beacon, as he says in the 1997 Labour Party conference speech, for the rest of Europe and even for the world. He wants to lead the world as this kind of new liberal modern power. And at first, actually, the Kosovo, Sierra Leone, even the Afghanistan war in the wake of 9/11, they all serve to, in a sense, increase Britain's influence in Europe. We look like we are the kind of martial leader of Europe at this point. It's the Iraq war that then kind of destroys this, divides Europe, weakens Britain's influence in Europe, and because it seems to have shown Britain almost in the same light that de Gaulle accused Britain of being right at the beginning, a kind of Trojan horse for American power. When push came to shove, you weren't a European power. You didn't think of yourself as a European. You didn't prioritize European solidarity. You sided with the Americans, as Britain had done in the other wars. And so from that moment, it became very, very difficult, I think, for Blair to be able to use defense, as all British prime ministers had tried to do, and ultimately, I think, failed, to lead Europe somehow, to increase Britain's influence in Europe, to be able to not have to face up to the challenge of joining this supranational, ever closer union that was emerging. We wanted to have our cake and eat it, and we were trying to use security to do so, and we couldn't. I don't think we could do it.
I think, though, Tom, by the moment the next shock comes, which isn't anything really to do with geopolitics or defence in one sense, which is the 2008 financial crash that all dead and buried. But the crash itself then has a very interesting consequence in terms of the story that you've just been telling, because the response of all the European states to the crash is we need to spend a lot less money on defence. When they're looking to make cuts, they want the cuts public expenditure cuts, I mean by that, to fall on defence. And you can see that really clearly with David Cameron's government. David Cameron comes in, head of the coalition government with the Liberal Democrats in 2010. What's going to be protected from public expenditure cuts is schools and health. And that means that there have to be defence cuts. And the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition government is far from alone in Europe in responding that way. The context in which there's, if you like, British-French rapprochement about defence that establishes the Lancaster House treaties that I think we've mentioned before, is that the French too have come to the conclusion that they want to cut defence expenditure, and that deeper cooperation with the British is a way of doing that. But I think that there's something that's really notable in the way in which that works out in practice, because here you have the British and the French government saying we need to slim down where defence is concerned, yet having both done that in 2010, in 2011, they want to lead a war in Libya. So the shock then coming at this new defence stance is the Arab uprisings of 2011. And it's not at all clear how either of the governments work out how they're joining up the two different commitments that they've made.
It's the same story that we've been telling throughout the entirety of this first half, in a way. We want to maintain our global influence as much as we can while spending dramatically less, ever more, over the years. You know, we're now talking about 2% of GDP, and we're desperately trying to maintain just above 2% of GDP at this point. Cameron is declaring in his strategic defence review of 2010 that we can maintain our global security and influence through international development spending, which is obviously a lot cheaper than military spending. As you say, then that starts to already come apart very quickly with the Arab Spring, the military action in Libya, and then it is blown apart. The very idea that this is a kind of rules-based international order where we can exert our influence through soft power is already gone anyway, but then it completely goes in 2014 with the Russian annexation of Crimea, which is perhaps where we need to leave the first half of this episode. But it is the same story, isn't it, that we've been trying to tell. It's an attempt to look at the world, divine how we can maintain our influence for the cheapest possible way, and then that world changing almost immediately.
It's the difficulty of aligning the defence commitments up with a changing geopolitical world. And I think that that's an intrinsically, you know, like, very difficult thing to do. But there's no doubt that it keeps happening over and over again. And I think that this, as we'll go on to talk about in the second half, Tom, is a real turning point in the story, because the pressure is, for different reasons, geopolitical shocks and financial pressure has been down, down, down. And now it's going to start to be up a bit, up a bit. Mm-hmm. And it's on that that we'll come back after the break.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back, everyone. So we finished the first half there talking about 2014, the Russian annexation of Crimea. 2014 was also the year of a NATO summit in Wales, actually, where Cameron led calls for everybody within NATO to hit 2% as a minimum target for defence spending, that's 2% of GDP. Cameron had come under a lot of pressure at this time from the Americans about the quite dramatic fall in Britain's military ability, really, and the cuts in military spending. Come under a lot of pressure, and it looked at one point that he was going to allow military spending to fall below 2%. He never did. But it was touch and go, and there was lots of stories at the time about, you know, can we include intelligence spending in this, pensions, overseas aid, all these kind of things, coming obviously from the Treasury. So the same story was playing out there, you know, that we were trying to maintain the role, but at a cheaper cost. And that was that was 2014. It's the Russian annexation of Crimea in March of that year that starts to really shift how we think about what kind of amount of money that we need to spend on military spending.
Well, I think you can say that in a way, Tom, but you could also argue, just from what you've just said, that actually it didn't penetrate that hard into the Cameron government. I think it is important to stress that this summit was in Newport, September 2014. So as you said, it's 6 months after the annexation of Crimea. And this is the Obama administration. It's not the Trump administration. And it's a lot of pressure that's being put on all the European members of NATO saying that you're not doing enough. Now, I think that part of the context is actually the way in which the European governments had responded to the financial crash, I mean, by that. So you had, in the immediate years after 2010, the US Secretary of Defense, or maybe he was a former Secretary of Defense at that point, Robert Gates, describing what had happened in those years as, quote, the demilitarization of Europe, where large swathes of the general public and the political class are averse to military force and the risks that go with it. And you might then say that the Obama administration was using Russia's annexation as a way of Crimea, as a way to press that argument, and it would have come anyway, because it's not like the Obama administration pursued a particularly confrontational policy towards Russia in response to the annexation. But I think it is really notable, as you said, Tom, that while Cameron wants that summit, it being held in the United Kingdom, to be his government acting as the cheerleader, if you like, for the Western alliance or the NATO alliance over Ukraine, he's very reluctant actually to do much afterwards to meet that defence commitment. Yeah. And indeed, if you go and look at the run-up to the 2015 general election, the pressure is actually coming from his Chancellor, George Osborne, to keep cutting at defence expenditure. I think it's only after the election, when Obama officials from the Obama administration put a lot of pressure on Cameron, that you start to see any action that's matching the rhetoric.
Yeah, and it's only minimal, isn't it, at the same time. He does the bare minimum to be able to assuage the Americans, meet the 2% target. I think it's interesting trying to think through this, though, because in a sense, what the Obama administration is trying to do is trying to pressure the Europeans to spend more so that it can spend less, you know, so it can be a bit more European than it currently is. And the Europeans are only able to cut their defence spending in the way that they have, demilitarise Europe, because of the American presence in Europe that has existed since the Truman, you know, doctrine in 47, and the, you know, the power of the dollar, the weakening of sterling, all of these things. These are all the fundamental reasons why the Americans have the role that they have, and the Europeans struggle to maintain the role that they once upon a time did have. So that, you know, we're responding to the world that exists in front of us, and it's an American world, but the Americans are trying to chivy the Europeans to do more, but it's kind of rational for the Europeans not to want to do more.
Well, I think that depends, doesn't it, on what interpretation is put on the pivot to Asia by Obama, as opposed to the way which Trump then dealt with the question of prioritising confrontation with China after 2016. Because if you look at it through the lens of Obama's stated policy, pivot away from the Middle East to Asia, it's not pivot away from Europe, at least not explicitly,
yep.
to China. That's much more, at least in overt terms, Trump's position.
Yep.
Nonetheless, I think if you were reading what was going on quite carefully at that point, you might say the logic of this, of pivot to Asia, will also be pivot from Europe.
Yeah.
And so you do need to think, in a world in which Russia is challenging territorial borders within Europe, about what the European response will be to that. And you're not really seeing, I think, very much. But I do think there is a response, and this is interesting, in British defence policy to the pivot away from the Middle East part of pivot to Asia. If you look at what happened in December of 2014, so that's 3 months after the NATO summit, that the British government said it was going to build a Royal Navy base in Bahrain.
Mm-hmm.
And actually explicitly use the language of returning east of Suez.
Mm-hmm.
If you go on to the strategic defence review that then had taken place by the next year, then that said that Britain had a new Gulf strategy, which would involve having a permanent and more substantial UK presence. So we've got a clear turn in the story mm-hmm. here. Now, whether that's funded to the degree that would mean that Britain could actually act as a independent military power in the Middle East again, I think is very much open to question. If you look at what Britain's been doing in the Red Sea over the last 4 months or so, it's very much been acting with the Americans rather than unilaterally. But I think that it isn't just in Europe that we see, with events in 2014 or geopolitical events in 2014, a turn back to the past in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing it in the Middle East too.
Yeah, because there's an interesting irony at play here, which is, as I mentioned just before, that Obama, in a sense, is trying to become more European. I mean that in that he, you know, he wants to be less militaristic, in some sense, get others to pay their fair share. And yet he is unwilling to give up the power at the same time. So he wants others to step up to the plate in Europe or in the Middle East so that they can turn their attention towards China, but without giving up that leadership role that they have. But you can have both. At some point, if Americans start withdrawing from Europe and the Europeans start to increase their spending on defence, they're going to demand more of a say in what is happening. And the fundamentals here are that Russia's invasion of Ukraine, its annexation of Crimea, are part of an attempt from Russia to say that the world is changing into a multipolar world where the Americans can't dominate globally. And that is the reality that they're going to have to face up to. And other powers are going to start being able to assert themselves. And you wonder if that's part of the story here of why you're starting to see European military spending start to increase quite considerably. Although, you know, to be fair, that maybe is a story that's going to happen post the actual invasion of eastern Ukraine rather than Crimea. At this point in time, maybe everyone is clinging to the kind of the old world where the Americans are still ultimately in charge and will try their best to get the Europeans to spend more, but the Europeans are very reluctant because they don't have to.
Yeah, I think that it's more second kind of turn at this point. I think the turn from British defence policy is real in the Middle East. I'm not so sure it's real in relation to the Russia issue. It's doing whatever can just about be done to satisfy the Americans over the 2% of GDP. I think, though, what's really interesting is before we get to Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, that there's another turn in the story, which comes when Boris Johnson is prime minister. He begins what is effectively another defence review. It comes out in March 2021 as the integrated review. And he is promising at that point what he calls, anyway, the biggest programme of investment in defence since the end of the Cold War. And the geopolitical context for that isn't any of the places that we've thus far been talking about. It's China. That's the framing that's taken over by the time that this review comes out. So this is the early months of Biden's presidency when it's clear that there is going to be continuity from, already clear there's going to be continuity from Trump's confront China policy into Biden's confront China policy. And here we're talking about a British government saying that there's got to be a greater focus on naval power again, not naval power in the Middle East now, but naval power in the Indo-Pacific. And that is the framing which is going to justify what was promised then to be an increase in defence expenditure. Now, when you look at it in absolute terms, it's not anything like the grandiose rhetoric that Johnson's putting round.
It surprised me.
but it's a response, I think, to the fact that in that period between 2019-2020, that the British government came under really intense pressure from the Trump administration to get tougher with China, and that this pressure then turns up in a new statement about defence priorities.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this happens. This is an SDSR, Strategic Defence Review, that happens before the Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine. And so is immediately seen as a document that is dated because it talks about China rather than land wars. It talks about Navy rather than tanks on the European battlefield. And in a sense, obviously, that is a reasonable critique. I think what it also is trying to do is trying to differentiate itself from that Cameron era world by saying that the Cameron era world saw everything as a rules-based international order that we needed to maintain, and that's gone. This is the Trump world, China world. This is a world of competing powers and anarchy, and it's the world of the Salisbury attack in Britain, Skripal poisoning. It's a world of proxies fighting each other. And so we have to engage with that reality. But again, it cannot help falling into that almost like it's the sort of the fate of British defence reviews, that they just immediately get taken over by a new challenge, which is Ukraine.
But there's one thing I think we should put in before that, because it does have a practical consequence, I think, the integrated review with a focus on China, which is AUKUS.
Yeah.
So this is the agreement that is reached in September, or made public anyway, in September of 2021, focused on submarines with Australia and the United States. It sends Macron into a fury,
yes,
French exclusion from that. And it is very much in line with the idea in the integrated review that the British naval power is going to be a player in the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, it's an expression of that world that I was just trying to explain, or the idea of the world from Johnson and those around him, that it is a more chaotic world where outside of the European Union, you have to have alliances with lots of different powers to protect your influence. So that can be with Australia and the United States in terms of AUKUS. It will in time evolve into relationships with Japan, with South Korea. It sees Britain getting involved in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's trying to stretch yourself into multiple different alliances rather than one, putting all your chips on kind of one alliance. Well, that's one part of the idea. And it's also an idea that, you know, in a sense, you know, playing nice is old-fashioned. You know, if we have to really screw over the French to do this deal because it's in the British interest, we'll do it, you know, and we'll secretly negotiate this deal, and the Australians will rip up their partnership with the French and just immediately turn up on the Zoom call with Boris Johnson and Donald Trump announcing a new nuclear submarine partnership. I mean, it was kind of an extraordinary moment, and it's going to outlast, you know, maybe it will be one of the signature achievements of this conservative reign from 2010 to perhaps sometime this year. Although I think it seems to, the French are still sort of trying to chip away at it, but we'll see what happens there. But I think it is emblematic of this move into a much more geopolitical world that seems less ordered. I mean, I'm not sure that the world was ever particularly ordered in that
I'm not
time.
Really sure it ever was either. But I think it's also interesting that it comes at this moment in September of 2021, and then 5 months later, this very geopolitical world that you're describing, Tom, yields up yet another shock,
yeah,
which is Russia's invasion. And if you then go to what came to be called the refresh of the Integrated Review, which came out in 2023, then it's Russia that's been described, quote, as Britain's most pressing national security and foreign policy priority in the short and medium term. And the language on China is a bit softer in the 2023 version of this than it is in the 2021 version of this. I think, though, it's also really revealing that in terms of turning the changing rhetoric again into any meaningful promise of increased expenditure on defence, it isn't really there. And I think the moment that really brings that out very explicitly is in the autumn of that year. So this is after Liz Truss's short-lived, very short-lived premiership. And Rishi Sunak is Prime Minister, Jeremy Hunt is the Chancellor. And in the, I think it's an, is it an emergency budget or an autumn statement, whatever they do when they first come into office, Hunt says that he and Sunak recognise the need to increase defence expenditure in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but they're not, they're going to wait before making any specific commitment about how to do it. And it's really clear, I think, why, whatever the rationalisation offered is, and that is that the Truss moment in the financial markets and the fact that the increased borrowing had not only caused such havoc in the financial markets, but had finished a prime minister off, is scaring them. So if you're saying that the geopolitical world requires us to spend more on defence, but your heavily indebted country has just been bashed around in the financial markets and the foreign exchange markets, notice sterling is part of this story again, then actually acting on that promise is a whole other matter. And I think if you look at the statement that was then made by the time this review comes, the refresh review comes out, there is this commitment to saying that we will raise defence to 2.5% of GDP, but there is no date given for achieving this goal. So really the only change in the actual stated policy that's introduced by Sunak's speech in Berlin last week is now to set a date from this. I don't think in any way, shape or form that the underlying fiscal sterling fear around this has gone away.
Yeah, you have to be very careful. I mean, it's the age-old problem. You have to meet your commitments to your actual ability to pay for them. There's also something else going on, isn't there? You know, if you think about the world of the 50s or the 80s, where in the 50s you're spending 11% of GDP, in the 80s you're spending maybe something like 4% of GDP. Well, that's 4% of an economy that is much bigger relatively to other powers than it is today. So we are now saying we're going to try to get to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. The Labour Party haven't committed to the 2030 bit, but they've committed to the aspiration of 2.5%. But 2.5% of the British economy compared to the Indian economy now, or the German economy, or the Chinese economy, even to the Russian economy in terms of its purchasing power, sort of parity, once you strip away once you adjust for what you can actually buy with your currency, it doesn't get you the same amount of power that it once did. That's the other kind of reality that exists here. If we think about this story from 1950 to today, is that not only have you had a steady decrease in the amount that you commit to defence and a steadily decreasing size of military force that you get as a result of that. If you think the numbers that we've now got, it's something like a standing army of around 75,000. I think in the end of Mrs. Thatcher's time in government, it was something like 300,000 people in the army. So this is a dramatic fall. The reserves were supposed to be up to 40,000. That was the Cameron plan. I think they're now at about 25,000. So we just have a very small army, but we're seeking to maintain this kind of tier one status that they call it, which is the ability to act anywhere in the world, to be able to sustain your own military action independently. I think there was a story out on Sky News towards the end of last year that was saying that the Americans don't believe that we're a tier one military power anymore. Some people are saying we're barely a tier two military power. So even when you're thinking about the increase up to 2.5%, you wonder whether it's to sort of get back to a level that is still very, very low compared to what it used to be. And you then have to consider what that gets you relative to other powers. So now, for example, in Europe, you've got the Poles who are pushing at 4 to 4.5% of GDP, I think, is what they're looking to spend on their military. And that is obviously a much bigger economy relative to ours than it used to be. So they are becoming a, you know, a really important military actor in Europe where they didn't used to be. So I don't know. It's trying to understand British power and our strategy. It's going to have to be very different from what it used to be.
I think, though, if you look at the framing around the commitment that Sunak made last week, it's very much in economic terms, trying to tie increased defence expenditure to improving the UK's industrial base.
Yeah, that is interesting.
You could argue that, in one sense, it's trying to use defence expenditure as something of a growth strategy and not just any old growth strategy, but an industrial growth strategy. Now, that's quite a shift from where Boris Johnson started, which was, in a way, I would argue, to try to use the energy transition as an industrial strategy. Sunak's been less interested in that. Now he's pushing at the end of his effective end of his premiership at this, well, we can use defence for that purpose. And there's a lot of emphasis in the report that came out with the commitment about technology and making sure that this is technologically innovative defence spending. Now, it's a different question about whether that succeeds or not. I think, though, there's something else that's really revealing about the way in which the commitment has been framed, and that is in the geopolitics of it, which is really very centred around Ukraine. One of the things that the document says very explicitly near the beginning is Ukraine's security is our security. What we're seeing effectively is we are pinning, or this government has decided to pin, a not insignificant increase in British defence expenditure on defending the independence of Ukraine. And in that sense, I think, is downplaying the China, the Indo-Pacific commitment, downplaying in a way the Middle East commitment, even though British military has been acting in the Middle East and the Red Sea, as we've been talking about, you know, since like earlier in the year, and that British economic interests are more at stake in the Red Sea than they are in Ukraine. This is a quite strong statement about the way that this government anyway views the geopolitical world, and that is that Russia is a long-term threat, a medium to long-term threat, that maintaining Ukraine's independence is absolutely integral to being able to act against Russia.
And I think the subtext of that, it's integral to our ability to project power in this new world. So if it is, as I've sort of tried to describe it, one in which it's much harder to use your power globally than it once was, perhaps you can do it in Europe, in your own backyard, particularly once you've left the European Union, you get more bang for your buck here, particularly if the Americans are starting to hint or want to withdraw. And you get the idea that we're a reliable partner. We can be a partner for Eastern European countries like Poland, like Ukraine, the Baltics, Scandinavia. We can exert our influence here. And as you say, what's really fascinating in the framing of this document, which I'd urge listeners to go and have a read, it's alongside the Rishi Sunak speech on gov.uk, is it's the framing of it, of almost like a union document as well. It's like a map on there with, you know, where the military spending will benefit in Northern Ireland, in Scotland, in Wales, in the northwest, in Cumbria, how much per head is going to be spent in these regions. And as you say, as part of an industrial strategy, which seems also to be an acceptance that we are quite vulnerable. Should there be a sort of wider war, our industrial base isn't strong enough to sustain even the small military that we've got now. So it's kind of, it's seeking to repair what has been damaged over the past, well, let's say 13 years, but as we've discussed on this podcast, this is part of a much longer story. But at heart of it, to me at least, it's still the same old idea of using Britain's military strength, its position as a security power, to maintain some kind of influence. But I do wonder, to what end?
Well, I think that depends on what one thinks about the geopolitical framing of it. I mean, is it based on a serious geopolitical judgment that more than Ukraine's independence is threatened by Russia, that Russia is a long-term, territorially revisionist power, and that if it were to succeed in Ukraine, then other states' independence, from the Baltic states to Poland's, and obviously that is the context in which Poland wants to spend more money on defence, would also be threatened. And I think as well, it's interesting if you put this in an even longer historical context than the one which we've talked about, go back to the 1930s, when there are deep divisions about defence, where the threats are coming from, what kind of threat does Germany pose, what kind of, under Hitler, what kind of threat does the Soviet Union pose, is what there is in appeasement policy, if you like, was a considerable reluctance to make any kind of real commitment right until the end, and the commitment to Poland to defend the independence of any of those states that sat then between Germany and the Soviet Union. And some of the reasons why the people on the appeasement side were reluctant to do that was because they said, well, the empire is more important than what goes on with these East European states. And what this statement is saying is, the present Sunak's statement is that, if you like, world history, from Britain's point of view, is going to play out in those states that sit between Germany and Russia, in some sense, more than what we were saying before about what went on in China or our economic interests in the Middle East. And I'm not sure that that isn't only about, well, we need an industrial base and we need to strengthen our industrial base. It's quite possible that that is just the genuine worldview behind it, that something geopolitically has changed since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and that this is the world that we now face. I'm not necessarily saying that's the right geopolitical judgment, but I think that there's an argument for saying that it's quite a strong geopolitical claim that is being made.
Yeah, well, at the same time, that's not the American view, is it? That it all hinges on Ukraine. They're also effectively saying it hinges on Taiwan as well. So, you know, what are we supposed to do there? You know, I'm not sure we're able to fight two fronts in Iraq and Afghanistan, let alone Taiwan and Ukraine. But I mean, maybe that's for a future episode. Hopefully we've covered a lot of ground in that episode from 1945 to 2024. It feels like we've raced through it. But I think there are some obvious, you know, connecting threads that really do link Sunak's latest speech all the way back. I mean, I think we have run out of time there. I hope you enjoyed it. Please do like and subscribe and all of that, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
And as ever, this podcast was produced by Ewan Daughtry.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids.
Shop the all-new Tempur Adapt Collection at Ashley, in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.